The pig was named Kaiser Wilhelm, or Klein Willy for short. He was a piebald boar so gross that as he waddled into the oak forest, he reminded Michael of a bull hippopotamus. His pointed ears drooped forward over his eyes, and his tail curled like a roll of barbed wire up over his back, exposing ample evidence of his gender, contained in a bright pink sack that looked as though it had been boiled in oil.
"Vas-y, Willy, cherchez!"
cried Santin and Anna in unison. At the same time, it required both of them on the leash to restrain the enormous beast.
"Cherchez! Seek up!"
And the boar snuffled eagerly at the damp, chocolate-brown earth under the oak trees, dragging the two women behind him. Michael followed them, a spade over his good shoulder, laughing delightedly at the novelty of the hunt and trotting to keep up with it. Deeper into the forest, they came across a narrow stream running strongly with discoloured water from the recent rains, and they followed the bank with snorts and cries of encouragement. Suddenly, the pig let out a gleeful squeal and began rooting in the soft earth with his flat, wet snout.
"Is found one!"
Santin shrieked with excitement, and she and Anna hauled unavailingly on the leash.
"Michel!"
she panted over her shoulder. "When we get him away, you must be very quick with the sped. Are you ready?"
"Ready!"
From the pocket of her skirt, Santin pulled a wizened nub of truffle that was mildewed with age. She pared off a sliver with a clasp knife and held it as close to the boar's snout as she could reach. For a few moments the pig ignored her, and then it got the fresher scent of the cut truffle and grunted gluttonously, tried to take her hand in his streaming jaws. Santin jerked away and backed off with the boar following her.
"Quickly, Michel!" she cried.
And he went at the earth with the spade. In half a dozen strokes he had exposed the buried fungus, and Anna dropped on her knees and freed it from the earth with her bare hands. She lifted it out, crusty with chocolate soil, a dark, knobbly lump almost the size of her fist.
"Look, what a beauty!"
At last, Santin allowed the pig to take the sliver of fungus from her fingers, and when he had gulped it, she let him return to the empty hole and snuffle around in the loose earth to satisfy himself that the truffle had disappeared. Then,
"Cherchez!"
she shouted at him, and the hunt was on again. Within an hour, the small basket was filled with the unappetizing-looking lumpy fungi, and Anna called a halt.
"More than this will merely spoil. Now for some pigeons. Let's see if our captain from Africa can shoot."
They hurried after the boar, laughing and panting back through the open fields to the chateau, where Santin locked the truffles in the pantry, and Anna returned the boar to his stall in the cellars and then lifted the shotgun down from its rack on the kitchen wall. She handed the weapon to Michael and watched as he opened the breech and checked the barrels, then snapped them closed and put the gun to his shoulder and tried the balance. Despite the burns that hampered his swing a little, Anna could tell a good workman by the way he handled his tools, and her expression softened with approval. For Michael's part, he was surprised and then delighted to discover that the weapon was a venerable Holland and Holland. Only the English gunsmiths could fashion a barrel that would throw a perfectly even pattern of shot no matter how fast the gun was traversed. He nodded at Anna.
"Excellent!"
And she handed him the canvas bag of cartridges.
"I will show you a good place."
Santin took his hand to lead him and then saw Anna's expression and dropped it hurriedly.
"In the afternoon the pigeons come back through the woods," she explained.
They skirted the edge of the forest, Santin leading and lifting her skirts over the mud puddles so that Michael had an occasional flash of her smooth white calves, and his pulse accelerated beyond the exertion of keeping up with her. On her short, stubby legs, Anna fell far behind, and they ignored her calls,
the wet for me!"
At the corner of the forest, in the angle of the tee that the pilots used as the landmark for the return to the airfield, there was a sunken lane with high hedges on each side.
"The pigeons come in from there."
Santin pointed across the open fields and vineyards. "All of them overgrown and neglected.
We should wait here."
The hedgerow afforded excellent cover, and when Anna came up, they all three hid themselves and began to search the sky. Heavy, low cloud had begun to roll in again from the north, threatening rain and forming a perfect backdrop against which the tiny specks of a pigeon flock showed clearly to Michael's trained eye.
"There," he said, "coming straight in."
"I don't see them."
Santerne searched agitatedly.
"Where?" "Oh, yes, now I see them."
Although they were quick on the wing, they were flying straight and descending only gently towards the forest. For a marksman of Michael's caliber, it was simple shooting. He waited until two birds overlapped each other and took them both with his first shot. They crumpled in mid-air, and as the rest of the flock flared up and scattered, he knocked down a third pigeon in a burst of feathers with his second barrel. The two women raced out into the open field to bring in the birds.
"Three with two shots!"
Santerne came back and stood close beside him, stroking the soft, warm body of the dead pigeon and looking up at Michael.
"It was a fluke," said Anna gruffly. "Nobody shoots two pigeons by intention, not if they are flying."
The next flock was a larger one, and the birds were bunched. Michael took three of them with his first barrel and a fourth bird with his second, and Santerne turned triumphantly to Anna.
"Another fluke?" she gloated. "What luck the captain is having today."
Two more flocks came within range in the next half hour, and Santerne asked seriously,
"Do you ever miss, Mynheer?"
"Up there," Michael looked into the sky. "If you miss, you are dead. So far, I have never missed." Santerne shivered. Death. That word again. Death was all around them, on the ridges over there, where for the moment the sound of the guns was just a low rumble. Death in the sky above them. She looked at Michael and thought, "I don't want him to die.
Never. Never."
Then she shook herself, driving away the gloom, and she smiled and said,
"Teach me to shoot."
The request was inspired. It allowed Michael to touch her, even under Anna's jealous gaze. He stood her in front of him and coached her into the classic stance with her left foot leading. "This shoulder a little lower." They were both electrically aware of each contact. "Just turn your hips this way slightly." He placed his hands upon them, and Michael's voice sounded as though he were choking as she pushed back with her buttocks against him, an untutored but devastating pressure. Santerne's first shot drove her back against his chest, and he clasped her protectively while the pigeons headed untouched for the horizon. "You are looking at the muzzle of the gun, not the bird," Michael explained, still holding her. "Look at the bird, and the gun will follow of its own." At her next shot, a fat pigeon tumbled out of the sky, amid shrieks of excitement from both women. But when Anna ran out to pick it up, the rain that had been holding off until that moment fell upon them in a silver curtain.
"The barn!"
cried Santerne, and led them scampering down the lane. The rain slashed the treetops and exploded in miniature shell bursts on their skin, so that they gasped at its icy sting. Santerne reached the barn first, and her blouse was sticking to her skin, so that Michael could see the exact shape of her breasts. Strands of her dark hair were plastered against her forehead, and she shook the drops off her skirts and laughed at him, making no attempt to avoid his gaze. The barn fronted onto the lane. It was built of squared yellow stone blocks, and the thatched roof was tattered and worn as an old carpet. It was half filled with bales of straw that rose in tiers to the roof.
"This will set in," Anna groused darkly, staring out at the streaming rain and shaking the rain off herself like a water buffalo emerging from the swamp. "We will be stuck here."
"Come, Anna, let's clean the birds."
They found comfortable perches on the straw bales, Santerne and Michael, with their shoulders almost touching, and while they plucked the pigeons, they chatted.
"Tell me about Africa," Santerne demanded. "Is it really so dark?"
"It's the sunniest land in the world. Too much sun, even," Michael told her.
I love the sun. Santan shook her head. I hate the cold and the wet. There could never be too much sun for me.
He told her about the deserts where it never rained, not as much in a year as it does here in a single day.
I thought there were only black savages in Africa.
No, he laughed. There are plenty of white savages too, and black gentlemen. And he told her about the tiny yellow pygmies of the Ituri forests, tall as a man's waist, and the giant Watusi, who considered any man under 2 meters tall to be a pygmy, and those noble warriors of Zulu, who called themselves children of heaven.
You talk as though you love them, she accused.
The Zulu? He asked, and then nodded. Yes, I suppose I do. Some of them, anyway. Mbajane.
Mbajane?
She did not pronounce the name right. A Zulu. He has been with my Uncle Sean since they were lads together. He used the Zulu word umfan and had to translate for her.
Tell me about the animals.
Santan did not want him to stop talking. She could listen to his voice and his stories forever.
Tell me about the lions and the tigers.
No tigers, he smiled at her, but plenty of lions. And even Anna's hands, busy with plucking the birds, stilled as she listened while Michael described a camp on the hunting veld where he and his uncle Sean had been besieged by a pride of lions and had to stand by the horses' heads all night, protecting and soothing them, while the great pale cats prowled back and forth at the edge of the firelight, roaring and grunting, trying to drive the horses into the darkness, where they would have been easy prey.
Tell us about the elephants.
And he told her about those sagacious beasts. He described how they moved with that slow, somnambulistic gait, huge ears flapping to cool their blood, picking up dirt to dash it over their heads for a dust bath. He told them about the intricate social structures of the elephant herds, how the old bulls avoided the uproar of breeding herds.
Just like your father, said Anna,
and how the barren old queens took upon themselves the duties of nanny and midwife, how the great grey beasts formed relationships with each other, almost like human friendships that lasted their lifetimes, and about their strange preoccupation with death, how, if they killed a hunter who had plagued and wounded them, they would often cover his body with green leaves, almost as though they were trying to make atonement. He explained how, when one of the members of the herd was stricken, the others would try to succor it, holding it on its feet with their trunks, supporting it from each side with their bulks. And when it fell at last, if it was a cow, the herd bull would mount her, as though trying to frustrate death with the act of generation. This last tale roused Anna from a listening trance and reminded her of her role of chaperone. She glanced sharply at Santan.
It has stopped raining, she announced primly,
and she began to gather up the naked carcasses of the pigeons. Santan still watched Michael with huge, shining dark eyes.
One day, I will go to Africa, she said softly.
And he returned her gaze steadily and nodded.
Yes, he said. One day.
It was as though they had exchanged a vow. It was a thing between them, firm and understood. In that moment she became his woman, and he, her man.
Come, Anna insisted at the door of the barn. Come on before it rains again.
And it took a vast effort from both of them to rise and follow her out into the wet and dripping world. They dragged on leaden feet up the lane towards the chateau, side by side, not touching but so acutely aware of each other that they might as well have been locked in each other's arms. Then the planes came out of the dusk, low and swift, the thunder of their engines rising to a crescendo as they passed overhead. In the lead was the green Sopwith. From this angle they could not see Andrew's head, but they could see daylight through the rents in the fabric of his wings, through the lines of bullet holes which the Spandaus had torn. The 5 aircraft that followed Andrew had all been shot up as well. There were tears and neatly punched holes in their wings and fuselages.
It's been a hard day, Michael murmured, with his head thrown back.
Another Sopwith trailed the others, its engine popping and missing, vapour trailing back in a stream behind it, one wing skewed out of line where the struts had been shot through. Santan, watching them, shuddered,
and crept closer to Michael. "Some of them died out there today," she whispered, and he did not have to reply. "Tomorrow you will be with them again."
"Not tomorrow."
"Then the next day, or the next." Once more it was not necessary to reply. "Michel, oh Michel!" There was physical agony in her voice. "I must see you alone. We might never have another chance. From now on, we must live each precious minute of our lives as though it is the last." The shock of her words was like a blow to his body. He could not speak, and her own voice dropped.
"The barn," she whispered.
"When?" He found his voice, and it croaked in his own ears.
"Tonight, before midnight. I will come as soon as I am able to. It will be cold."
She looked directly into his face. Social conventions had been burned away in the furnace of war.
"You must bring a blanket."
She whirled and then ran to catch up with Anna, leaving Michael staring after her in a daze of disbelief and uncertain ecstasy.